fast-paced, smart talk, what's trending, and breaking news as it happens. The Guy Benson Show with Guy Benson.
Hey, hey, it's Friday, May 17th, 2019. Welcome to the Guy Benson Show. We made it. The first full week of this new program. I am Guy Benson here in Washington, D.C., the Tony Snow Radio Studios in our nation's capital, Fox News Bureau. Thank you for listening. And my goodness, what a week it has been. It began for me in Brussels, Belgium, then moved to Sochi, Russia, then back here to the U.S. This morning, I was on with Maria Bartiromo starting at 6 o'clock in the morning for 3 hours. I'll be on Martha McCallum's show, Fox News Channel, in the next hour. And we've got a monster program for you on this Friday, including the very latest on all the Russia investigation saga, I guess you would call it, the investigations into the investigations. We're sort of down that trail at this point, plus the controversy in Alabama over their abortion law. How does that compare to some of the draconian measures that we've seen in states like New York and Oregon at the other side of that whole issue? Plus, it is just confounding and confusing what's happening in the UK with Brexit. And I think it's confounding and confusing to them over there. They have no idea what's going on. Their leadership is in total chaos. There are elections coming up. Theresa May's on the way out. And so if they can't figure it out, it is particularly mystifying, I think, to Americans. We're going to cover that as well. Also coming up a little bit later on this hour, a controversial new program that the SAT is undertaking about assigning scores to students based on the adversity that they face in their life, and sort of stapling what they're calling an adversity score to the SAT score that those students get when they apply to colleges. Is this a good idea, or is this just another subjective identity politics social engineering plan run amok? We will debate that on the Guy Benson Show here tonight. I want to begin with some audio that broke this morning on Fox News Channel. Bill Hemmer, who's the co-host of America's Newsroom, one of my favorite programs on the network, he landed a big one. He got the first media sit-down with Bill Barr, the attorney general, since his testimony over the Mueller report. There were so many questions, so many things on everyone's mind, and Hemmer got the first crack at Barr. And there were some very, I think, interesting and thought-provoking exchanges that came out of the interview. I'm not sure a lot of questions were answered in terms of fundamental questions that a lot of us have, but we did get a window into what Barr is thinking and why he tapped this U.S. attorney from Connecticut, John Durham, to oversee this new probe, looking backwards as to how the now-resolved Mueller probe got started in the first place. I want to play some of that audio for you here in this opening segment of tonight's show, because I think it's big news, and tip of the cap to Hemmer for it's a good get. It's a good get for America's Newsroom. All right, I want to start actually with cut three here. And what I find interesting, so this is right on the heels of another answer where Barr basically said he was asking around, trying to get his arms around what actually happened. What was it that led to, for example, the dossier being the Steele dossier, right? Remember that? The British former spook went out, got all this information on Trump. We know some of it was absolutely false. There are now serious suggestions that some of it might have been disinformation planted against Trump, possibly by the Russians, believe it or not, of all people. They were sort of playing both sides, potentially, in this whole high-stakes geopolitical game. And that doesn't necessarily surprise me. I think they're kind of ingenious when it comes to espionage and disinformation. How did that dossier, much of which is discredited, end up in the mainstream bloodstream of the intelligence community and the FBI and the DOJ, so much so that it ended up as a pillar of the FISA warrants that then justify, with judges signing off, some surveillance or spying on Trump-related people back during the 2016 campaign? We don't know that. We don't also know exactly who knew and when that a lot of the information was dubious, to put it kindly, in the Steele dossier. So as I've made clear, I think, on this program, I was a supporter from the beginning of the Mueller investigation. I did not believe it was a witch hunt, and I defended Mueller and thought he should have been continued or allowed to continue his investigation without interruption, without interference, and give us his answers. We got that, okay? We've seen there was no collusion. He couldn't make a decision on obstruction, and here we are. The attorney general made that decision for him because he punted on that. And now we're pivoting, I think, as a country. Those of us who have watched this story for the last 2+ years play out, how did this ball get rolling? We don't quite know. We have bits and pieces of it. But what Barr says to Hemmer this morning, he said the answers that he sought on that exact series of questions sort of within this realm, he said, quote, the answers I'm getting are not sufficient. So he smells something off, which is why he has called this U.S. attorney from Connecticut down to look into this. Guy has a very strong reputation across party lines. He's looked into the intelligence community and investigated them in the past. So in cut three, this is sort of fleshing out some of these suspicions or ongoing questions that Barr says he has. Listen.
I've been trying to get answers to questions, and I found that a lot of the answers have been inadequate. And I've also found that some of the explanations I've gotten don't hang together. So in a sense, I have more questions today than I did when I first started.
Some of what things don't hang together?
Some of the explanations of what occurred.
Why does that matter?
Because I think people have to find out what the government was doing during that period. If we're worried about foreign influence, for the very same reason, we should be worried about whether government officials abused their power and put their thumb on the scale. And so I'm not saying that happened, but I'm saying that we have to look at that.
I agree completely. Right, I actually was deeply concerned about foreign influence in the 2016 election, which we know for a fact happened. The Russians did it. That is now proven, I think it's conclusive, from the Mueller investigation, which is why I favored it all along. But I'm also concerned, were there abuses by government officials in a potentially politicized Department of Justice or intelligence community against a presidential campaign? He was careful. He said, did they put their thumb on the scale? Talking about those officials and the possible abuses. Barr says, I'm not saying that happened. He's not getting out over his skis and making bombshell allegations. For example, like there was collusion, right? He's not saying that, but he's saying we have to look at it. And that's why, just like I supported Mueller, I now support Durham and also Horowitz, the inspector general. I also want to play one more clip from the Barr-Hemmer interview. In cut four, this is one of the complaints that we've heard from some on the left saying, look, the IG, Horowitz, who I just mentioned, he's already looking at possible FISA abuses. And apparently he's making some headway, I'll remind you. We've gotten indication, dribs and drabs along the way, that there might have been some abuses or misconduct. We'll see what he actually comes up with in his report. I don't want to jump to any conclusions yet, but there are some indications based on the types of questions he's asking certain witnesses reportedly. He seems to be hot on the trail of something. And there are rumors that he might also be looking into the culture of leaking that surrounded all of that. But if Horowitz is on the case, why did Barr bring in Durham from Connecticut to kind of double up on some of this stuff? In cut four, Barr explains why.
The fact of the matter is, Bob Mueller did not look at the government's activities. He was not going back and looking at the counterintelligence program. And we have a number of investigations underway that touch upon it, the main one being the Office of Inspector General that's looking at the FISA warrants. But as far as I'm aware, no one has really looked across the whole waterfront.
That's a good way of putting it. The whole waterfront of these issues, someone needs to step back and examine all of it. He said Mueller didn't get into any of it. And we know that. We've read the report. The IG is looking at the FISA warrants in particular, maybe leaking, but it's narrow. That probe is pretty limited in its charge, in its nature. And so this is a step back, full view, give us some answers, and hopefully, for crying out loud, we can move on from all of this. But I think we need those answers. And if there are people who need to be held accountable, then we'll see what that would look like, and I'd be in favor of that as well. But the crucial part now is gathering the facts, and we don't have them yet. Last piece, cut five, was Barr surprised that Mueller didn't really answer the obstruction of justice question? He said, yes, he was. Here's why. Listen.
You mentioned Bob Mueller a few moments ago. Were you surprised that he came back with no recommendation on that obstruction charge? That surprised you?
Yes, that surprised
me. How come?
The function of a prosecutor is to make a call one way or the other.
Did you ask him why?
Yeah, we discussed it.
What did he say?
Well, I already have said that we met on March 5th before he delivered the report, and he gave an explanation for it, and it's pretty much reflected in the report.
There are a lot of people in Congress who would like to hear, and frankly, the American people, if you look at polling, who would like to hear from Robert Mueller to maybe get into more details and more specifics about why he laid out all these possible strands that would lead to obstruction, and then some of the countervailing points, and then had this long sort of convoluted explanation for why he wasn't going to make a decision. I'm not sure a lot of people were totally persuaded by that or satisfied with that portion of the report. So people want to hear from him. So far, though, the rumor was it was going to be this past Wednesday. Well, now it's Friday. It didn't happen. There are ongoing alleged negotiations over this, according to Barr. We saw that yesterday in the Wall Street Journal. But I'll admit I'm a little bit surprised that Mueller hasn't agreed to this, or at least agreed in principle. We know nothing. It's a black box still what Mueller's going to say, if anything at all. So if we go, let's say, another week or two with nothing on this, then I'll start to really scratch my head about why Mueller might not want to testify. But for now, we'll see if those talks are ongoing and if they come up with something. I would be interested in hearing from Robert Mueller on a number of fronts, but there's a chance that he might not want to testify. He's like, I wrote 450 pages. I spent 2 years of my life on this. My testimony is the report. Good day. That's possible. I don't know. I'm not convinced. It's one of the unanswered questions here. It's a small ball one comparatively, but it's one of the many permutations of this never-ending story that is, I guess, interesting to some of us, but not to a lot of the American people, it does seem, based on a lot of polling. When we come back on the Guy Benson Show, I teased this earlier, the SAT. I think if you applied to college, you almost certainly took the SAT or the ACT. The SAT is changing things up a little bit. They've created something called an adversity score. I'll explain what that means, and then we're going to take some of your calls on whether or not you think this is a good idea. So write down the phone number, 833-456-1300, 833-456-1300, details, and then your calls coming up on The Guy Benson Show.
A fresh take on the biggest stories of the day. It's Guy Benson.
Show. That's a 90s classic. Say by the Bell. I mean, let's be honest. The show was hot garbage, but the song is awesome.
Hey.
It was bad.
No need to be so rude on a Friday.
It was not quality television.
It was,
right?
it was everything. It was my childhood.
It was. No, I agree. It was campy, and for a certain age group, it's nostalgic, but like I watched an episode recently, and I was like, wow, this writing is atrocious. But the theme song's amazing and iconic, and that's why we played it coming back for this new topic on the show. So I want to read to you, this is a story in the Wall Street Journal this week. If you've ever applied to college or taken standardized tests, I think this is interesting. The College Board plans to assign an adversity score to every student who takes the SAT to try to capture their social and economic background, jumping into the debate raging over race and class in college admissions. This new number, called an adversity score by college admissions officers, is calculated by using 15 factors, including the crime rate and poverty levels from the student's high school and neighborhood. This is interesting. Students won't be told their own scores, but colleges will see the numbers when reviewing applications. They've done a pilot program of 50 colleges in the past year. They're trying to expand it now to 150 institutions this coming fall. The College Board, which is based in New York, it's a nonprofit, oversees the SAT, says it is worried about income inequality influencing test results for years. White students scored an average of 177 points higher than black students. This is on the 1600 scale. And 133 points higher than Hispanic students in 2018. Asian students scored 100 points higher than white students. And the children of wealthy and college-educated parents outperformed their classmates. So they go through and they quote an admissions officer at Yale saying this is affecting every application. It's helping us diversify. You have a college counselor at New Trier High School, up near Northwestern, actually, in the suburbs of Chicago on the north side, saying that it's starting to tip in the opposite direction where there was discrimination in the past, and he's worried that this is now becoming reverse discrimination. It's very controversial. It does not take into account race. It does not take into account race. So of those 15 factors that build an adversity score, the race of the applicant is not included. The average score, apparently, for an adversity score is 50. I don't quite understand what the full, I guess it's a 1 through 100 scale. So the average adversity score is a 50. Anything above 50 designates hardship. Anything below 50 designates privilege. So I guess the question, and I'll put out the phone number, 833-456-1300, 833-456-1300, is this a good idea? Now, I want to make something clear. The adversity score is not being added or subtracted from the actual SAT score, right? You have the 1600 scale. I still remember my SAT score because I'm a nerd. You have the 1600 scale, and students will still have that score, right? That's not going to be affected by their privilege or whatever. But there will be basically attached, there'll be a profile of the student's neighborhood or community and likely income level that will then allow, I guess, college admissions officers to take the score into a broader context. So I'll admit that when I saw the headlines, I was pretty unhappy with this idea. I was not a fan. I will concede a few points. Namely, it's just true, right? If you come from a rich or privileged background, your parents can probably afford to get you a tutor to take these tests better, or a class of some sort, right? There are more resources available to you. Now, there are other less well-off parents that will save specifically for that purpose, who prize education. But there are some disparities here where wealthier kids have an upper hand. But does that justify coming up with an adversity score for every student that they don't even see themselves and sending it off to the college along with their other scores? I feel like the beauty of an SAT or an ACT, it's the equalizer. It's just an objective measure without this subjectivity coming into it. I have mixed feelings on this. There are some arguments that I find persuasive in favor of this idea, which I'll explain after the break, and also take your calls. Do you like this plan? 833-456-1300, The Guy Benson Show. Your toll-free connection. Here to the Guy Benson Show, debating this Wall Street Journal story about the SAT, the venerable standardized college admissions test, the SAT, adding this new thing called an adversity score based on the crime rates in the applicant's neighborhood, the relative wealth and affluence of that neighborhood or the school district. 15 of those factors culminating in an adversity score that does not change the actual SAT score of these students, but it's an additional score being offered to college administrators. What do you think of this? 833-456-1300. We're going to get to your calls in just a second. I want to make one point, because my instinct was to be against it. However, I think that this was perhaps a good faith effort to hopefully move us past race-based administration decisions when it comes to admissions. There was a Pew poll that came out just recently. 73% of Americans, the vast majority of Americans, are against using race, the skin color of an applicant, to make decisions about letting someone into school. And that includes super majorities of black voters, Hispanic voters, Asians, and whites. Across the board, Americans oppose this. And so do I. I think race-based affirmative action is wrong. I think it's unfair. I think socioeconomic factors are actually a fairer metric if we're going to give someone a leg up. Because you can be a dirt poor white person in a terrible school district in Appalachia somewhere who needs an advantage more than an upper class African American person from a very wealthy town with very wealthy parents in an excellent school district, or you went to some, you know, prestigious boarding school, right? It shouldn't just be skin color. I think there are other factors that if we're looking for real fairness and diversity, we can look elsewhere than race. So if this adversity score, which is supposedly race blind, could replace or supplant the metric of race, I think that would be an improvement, in my opinion. I think the issue here is the adversity score is being layered on top of all these other judgments and box checking and subjective measures. And I think there is some concern, are we turning standardized testing into subjective testing? Well, that score doesn't really reflect really how smart you are because of all these other factors. And also, isn't it possible that a very wealthy kid had an absolutely horrible life and had all sorts of adversity that would never come up in the adversity score? I guess you could put that in your essay or something. But it's tricky. It's not simple. But I'm not as opposed to this as I thought I was going to be after I read the piece. What do you think? 833-456-1300. Let's begin with John calling from Chicago, listening on Sirius XM. John, glad you're here. The floor is yours. What do you think?
I think that this is kind of dumbing down the whole situation to what you said. You know, it started out as good intentions, but you're really, I believe that the pieces is your, that's really the heart of this, is it really kind of dumbs down a kid who might be a very high achiever in an urban school, doesn't have to push as hard to get that to that next level of you know, schooling or level of quality of schooling that they had to work for before.
I was going to say the point that you've made is actually a very interesting one, and I want to play an audio soundbite because they interviewed some students about this idea, and there was a student who's a racial minority in the San Francisco Bay Area named Ihim, who is not a fan of this idea because he's like, hey, if you're giving me these points just because of where I come from, it's like I can't do it on my own. Listen to Cut 24.
Just because we are from a certain area, because we look a certain way, because we're a certain race, certain economic status, that now we have to have benefits. Like, we cannot do it on our own. If they looked at me for who I was as an actual student, they would be very impressed.
I think that's a great point from this kid, and sort of a counterpoint to what I've been saying. And John, it sort of goes along with exactly what you're suggesting here, which is some students might feel disincentivized to work extra hard because they think they're going to get these extra points for their adversity. And at least some of them, it sounds like, would kind of resent that.
That's true. But I also think that this is just one step. I mean, it's a step from where we've come from and a step to where we're going. But I also think that the next piece to this will be, well, listen, we tried to level the playing field by doing it by race. That didn't work. We tried to do it, now level the playing field by geographical and societal measures. That doesn't work. Now people are being held back because maybe they can't afford to get into a higher education. By putting this as like almost like a multiplier, it really is a push to get us to, you know, free education beyond high school, higher education.
All right, John, I appreciate the call. Thanks for calling. 833-456-1300. 833-456-1300. Yeah, I mean, I'm not convinced that this I think this is better than race-based affirmative action. And I'm not convinced that it doesn't work necessarily. I think it's very early in this process. I would prefer this, I think, to the previous system. I just wonder, are there flaws? And I'm sure there are flaws, but in the whole, holistically, is this a better idea than not? I mean, it's interesting to me. 833-456-1300. Back to the phones. Sal calling from Charlotte, listening on the Fox News app. Sal, welcome to the Guy Benson Show.
So I don't think it makes it a better system. I think it highlights the fact that maybe the SATs is not the right way to include, you know, to try to pick out the students that should go to college or go to that particular college, right? So you got a system that of college recruiting that's exclusionary in its nature, right? And then they're trying to fix it by including some type of inclusive and diversity type thing that's telling us that the original system, the SAT, doesn't work.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that, Sal, and I appreciate your perspective. Thank you very much for the phone call at 833-456-1300. I have never believed that the SAT is some sort of amazing gold standard that proves who the best students are and who can succeed in college or in life, right? It is not the end-all, be-all. Some people just aren't good at taking standardized tests, right? There are multiple factors that go into some of these decisions. I would prefer this type of supplementary information going to college admissions officers rather than dumbing down the test itself, right? It's not the only thing. I think GPA and extracurriculars and recommendations and essays, all of that stuff should matter when you're considering an applicant. But I do think having, whether it's the ACT or the SAT, some sort of benchmark that applies to everyone the same way, and your score is your score, period. No matter what the outside or ancillary reasons are, that's your score. I think it's important to keep that. The question is, if we're looking for fairness and diversity and kids who were underprivileged and underrepresented and didn't have the resources that wealthier kids have, how do you sort of balance that a little bit and tilt the playing field back a little bit to be fairer to those other kids? That is not an easy question, and I think that this adversity score is certainly better, as I've said, than race. One point that our producer Christine made, we're up on a break here, but she said, will people claim to live in different places or move, like, for 6 months to stay there from somewhere to get that advantage on the adversity score? That's a can of worms. Good question. More Guy Benson Show coming up after this.
Let your voice be heard. Call 833-456-1300. The Guy Benson Show.
Benson Show. So last night I was at an event here in D.C. I actually interviewed Senator Josh Hawley on stage. He's the freshman senator from Missouri, the youngest member of the U.S. Senate. Always good to see him. Hopefully we'll get him back on the show in the coming days. But during one of the receptions, this gentleman approached me and he had a smooth head and he had a sport coat and a t-shirt on. And I said, hang on, I know that look. It belongs to Steve Hilton of Fox News. He hosts The Next Revolution every Sunday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, Fox News Channel. He was there for, I guess he had been invited by one of our mutual friends to this event, and we started chatting, and he said, well, I happen to be in town because I was just at the White House. I had an interview with President Trump. His team reached out to Steve's show. Apparently, the president was watching and liked what he saw and said, hey, I want to do an interview. Which is sometimes how the president operates with our network, which can be delightful for the hosts who get that phone call. So Steve had his first one-on-one with President Trump, and he said, there was a part of the interview, Guy, that I think you'd be very interested in. I asked the president about Pete Buttigieg, the Democrat running for president from Indiana. He's the mayor of South Bend. He's openly gay. He's got his spouse, his husband, on the campaign trail with him all the time. And I asked him about that, and wondered whether or not Trump thought that was a sign of progress, and his answer was really interesting. So we were chatting back and forth about it, and I said, that is interesting. And he said, no, my team has tweeted it out. The video's out there. The full interview airs on Sunday night, this coming Sunday night on Fox News in the 9 p.m. hour. But, you know, to promote certain things, they'll leak out a few clips here or there. We did that with our Pompeo interview yesterday. So sure enough, when the event ended, I hopped in the Uber and I pulled up the Twitter feed and I watched this exchange, and Steve Hilton did not exaggerate how it went down. I thought this was, frankly, very interesting and significant. Cut 28, listen to Trump's answers.
Don't you think it's just great to see the fact that you've got a guy there on the stage with his husband? And it's normal. It's not even.
I think it's absolutely fine. I do.
And, but isn't it a sign of great progress in the country that that's just.
Yeah, I think it's great. I think that's something that perhaps some people will have a problem with. I have no problem with it whatsoever. I think it's good.
I think it's great. I have no problem with it whatsoever. That's President Trump talking about the openly gay Democratic candidate for president, Pete Buttigieg, and his husband, and how they are sort of in this normal way campaigning together. And look, I am not here to get on the soapbox. You know that I'm openly gay, or many of you do. That's part of who I am. I don't talk about it all the time. I will say that this, to me, is important. To hear a Republican president with, what, 90% approval among Republican voters, saying, yeah, I'm just chill with this. I'm fine, and I think it's great. To me, that is indicative of a bit of a sea change. We've seen polling on this. I wrote a piece at townhall.com on this exchange today, and I also have written about it in the past. Pew and other data, other pollsters have shown Republican voters shifting massively on the question of same-sex marriage, even compared to 10 years ago, 12 years ago, 15 years ago. I mean, the numbers are not even close. I think in the Pew numbers that I cited, there is a 52-point swing in favor of gay marriage. So it's about even among Republicans. Nationally, it's a 60% approval or more for same-sex marriage. Among Republicans, it's about exactly even. I think the number I saw was 48 against 47 for, something like that, percentages. That is reflective of a Republican Party and a conservative base that has some disagreements on LGBT issues. And I think for the president to say what he said, which was, I think, reflective of inclusivity, to me, it was just another reminder that the party's platform needs to play some catch up here. The platform is still stuck in the past. I'm not asking you to change your definition of marriage necessarily. I think we can have that debate. We can probably have a disagreement politely. I think the vast majority of folks who hold a traditional view of marriage don't do so because they hate gay people. I think labeling them all a bunch of bigot haters, I think, is really unfortunate and unfair and counterproductive if you're trying to win hearts and minds. I'm not trying to say you need to accept a new definition of marriage in your life or in your faith, but when it comes to the law, when it comes to the new post-Obergefell universe that we live in, and by the way, the president said he was fine with the outcome of Obergefell, which legalized gay marriage. When you have the president of the United States, the Republican president of the United States, saying that he thinks Buttigieg and his husband out there in a normal way on the campaign trail is great, and he has no problem with it whatsoever, that he's not just there himself, he's bringing along with him many millions of Republican voters. And I think where the party officially stands in the platform on these issues needs to change. We're not asking everyone to uproot their values or change their principles, but if you want to invite more people into a party, into a bigger tent, and not have a barrier to entry on some of these tough issues, you need to signal to people that we're going to be more inclusive if you're the Republican Party. We recognize that there are voices within the party who disagree in good faith, and we want our platform to at least suggest that we are open in a more modern way to that inclusivity. Now, how that exactly looks and plays out as a political platform, that's something to be debated. But I think digging in the heels and entrenching oneself in the old school hardcore platform. I just think the party is well past that point. And I think the president is leading on it, as we just heard in that clip. So you might not agree with Trump or me on that issue, but I think it's important to acknowledge that many, 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 many right-leaning and centrist voters agree with what Trump said. And to have officially the party on the record in the platform so far away from that, almost on a different planet from that type of attitude, I think that that needs to be updated and refreshed a little bit. So last point I'm going to make on the LGBT rights front, I know the Trump administration gets lots of heat from activists and advocates. I think sometimes they deserve it. But between Peter Thiel giving his speech at the RNC in 2016, where he said he was proudly gay, he got a standing ovation, between my friend Richard Grenell making history as the first openly gay ambassador to Germany, appointed by a Republican president anywhere in the world, but he happens to be assigned to Germany. That was significant. You have the president making the comments that we saw just this week that will air on Sunday night on Fox News Channel, plus the big initiative that the administration has undertaken to fight criminalization of homosexuality laws around the world, a big deal that they just struck to make anti-HIV medication more available to more people for less money. There are some big factors on the other side of the ledger that I don't think the administration is getting credit for. So I'm someone who's sort of straddling these worlds, and I just want to raise some points when I think the administration deserves credit. And I think this should be a relatively big story, Trump saying what he did in response to Steve Hilton's question. I'm glad Steve asked the question, and I'm glad the president answered it the way he did. We're not asking anyone to abandon their principles or abandon their faith, but it's time to recognize in today's conservative movement, whatever that looks like or however that's constituted, acceptance or just a little bit more chill, frankly, on these issues is not just necessary, it's where the president is as well. And I wanted to bring that to your attention. All right, I'm going to climb down off the mini soapbox on that, but that's news. I think that is news. And I look forward to watching the interview with the president with Steve Hilton Sunday night, 9 p.m., the next revolution on Fox News Channel. All right, more Guy Benson Show coming up straight ahead.